bin Siri, dein virtueller Assistent.
Sono Siri, l'assistente virtuale.
Watashi wa Siri, anata no virtual assistant desu.
Watashi Siri, assistente virtuale.
I'm Siri, your virtual assistant.
Siri, repeat after me. Book talk.
I'm an intelligent assistant, not a parrot with beautiful plumage.
Mi gente!
This podcast is part of BTR Today. BTRtoday.com is the home of a plethora of podcast videos and articles. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and help us out by sharing. You can subscribe to this podcast in Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, and most other apps where you listen to podcasts.
We made a mistake. There's no getting around it. We had to have a revolution, and all those people I had been fighting were now my friends.
What are you talking about?
I think in today's political climate, there's two areas of focus that editors, the news media, talk show hosts, and our current academics and cultural thinkers focus on. One is the question of divide, how split the country is on every single topic that seems to be affecting or important in today's society. And the second is arguably leadership. What does it mean to be a leader? There's no doubt that Trump has a big following. There's no doubt that the people who love and support Trump do so with great loyalty and affection. And I think a lot of people right now, from where we sit in the summer of 2018, think that it's a very strong possibility that Donald Trump will be reelected in 2020. People who voted for Donald Trump wanted to shake up Washington. Shake up the way the country was managed and run, and we're tired of century-old political backroom negotiations where nothing gets done and it's all about side conversations and personal gain. Well, Trump has definitely changed the way that America talks amongst themselves as well as talks to the rest of the world. Trump may be a good negotiator or great at making deals, or good at representing and sticking up for the people that support him. Is he a great leader? Are his speeches great? Is his Twitter account the new form of public speaking? Obviously, the people who oppose Donald Trump and the news media who dislike him or think him to be a buffoon will always capitalize on moments of his public speaking where he is dead set wrong, where he lies, where he makes things up, and where he looks like a bit of an idiot. But does it matter in today's world when you have Facebook and Twitter and foreign entities tricking American voters into vote the way that they want to? How far can words go? How far can we trust what anyone's saying? I think that's why Donald Trump was elected. It was based on the idea of they're all bullshitting. They're all lying. At least we know with Donald Trump, his whole fake news mantra. On June 6th, it's the 50th anniversary of the death of Robert Kennedy. He was assassinated in California. And on June 6th of this year, we have a 50th anniversary edition of a book called RFK, His Words for Our Times. Today on Book Talk, Rick Allen, who's been a lifelong study of RFK, was a campaign manager for several presidential and Senate candidates, helped create AmeriCorps, his friends and family with Kennedy advisors, and was a government service employee in Bill Clinton's White House. And he is going to be on today to talk about RFK, his words for our times, and how we need to revisit the words of Robert Kennedy so we can help understand and maybe steer the future of politics and leadership in this country. One of the things that Rick tells me is that this book is not just for the baby boomers who remember Robert Kennedy, but to try and reach millennials today who might not know that much about him. As such, I'm featuring some new music from Melbourne, Australia, a little bit of electronic sound. This is Confidence Man, confident music for confident people. You're tuned into Book Talk with Corey here on BTR Today. Welcome back, listeners. I am now joined on the phone with Rick Allen. He is one of the editors of RFK, His Words for Our Times, which is a 50-year anniversary on the assassination death of RFK, one of the great leaders in American history. Rick, thanks so much for coming on the phone with us today.
Great to be with you.
Now, in reading a little bit about you, I think I came across that you're a media and tech executive. Is that a fair thing to call you?
Yeah, I think so. I've been running media and technology companies for a while now.
How did you fall into that? Did you start coding early DOS systems in the 80s and 90s?
Well, would that I had that kind of background. No, I was a lawyer initially.
Okay.
Doing international corporate work, got into business running a group of companies in Los Angeles, came out to D.C. to be part of the Clinton administration as a deputy assistant to the president, and helped to put together the AmeriCorps program,
right.
Domestic Peace Corps.
Very fascinating program that you guys were able to put together back then.
Really, really proud of what AmeriCorps members, over a million of them, have accomplished all around the country in community-based organizations where they're really getting things done for the American people. And it was a great experience, and as I say, I'm so proud of the program in the years since. And then after that, I went to work at Discovery, and then ran National Geographic for a number of years, and another media company called Sporting News, and ultimately founded our current company with Ted Leonsis, who is a tech visionary and pioneer and sports team owner and philanthropist and filmmaker and many hyphens to his talents, but our companies are Snag Films and ViewLift.
Have you been shortlisted or eyeballed by Trump's administration? He seems to like to get executives and business people around him at the White House.
I tend to be identified with the other party. I've been involved in politics really since Robert Kennedy's campaign in 68, when I was just barely a teenager. I was planned to be a volunteer on the New York campaign, which really wasn't a primary in 68. There were very few direct election primaries, but I was excited to be handing out leaflets and whatnot in that presidential campaign. And then I've been involved, particularly in the years we lived in California,
right.
Writing speeches, raising money, running campaigns, chairing campaigns, doing a bunch of different things.
What is your opinion of mixing business with Washington? Let's anchor this question in a Rex Tillerson. Do you think that is something that should be done more often? Should we get major executives? Could Bill Gates do a lot for Washington D.C. at the federal level, or should Bill Gates stay the heck out of it? Like, what happened to Rex Tillerson? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's really a great question. I can tell you from my personal experience, I came in to the Clinton administration in part because of business experience, but also having thought about what a domestic peace corps would look like for a very substantial period of time, and knowing a little bit about that specific area. I think that business skills are useful in government, in political positions selected by an administration. I think it's very easy for businessmen to be overly impatient, and I think each of us has our own level of hubris. I came into government when we created a government corporation to run AmeriCorps. it was an interesting structure that was supposed to combine the best aspects of the private sector and government. And I frankly didn't do as good a leadership job as I would like because I made assumptions that business rules necessarily applied, and I didn't have the adequate respect that I should have for the traditions and culture of public service in government agencies. And so I learned a great deal in a very brief period of time. I'm not sure that Secretary Tillerson learned those lessons in his tenure, because he was a far more experienced businessman, particularly at that point in his career, than I was. And I think he came from a perspective that tended to undervalue the contributions of the individuals that are serving in our government at all levels.
Right.
Again, I say from having made too much of that mistake myself, so I have sympathy for business leaders who come in and act like a bull in a china shop, but it's not the most effective way to get things done. And those who are more conversant, people tend to look down their noses at the sense of knowing the ways of Washington. It's not about doing something behind the back of the public. It's trying to do the public's work in the light of day most efficiently. And I found that the people who are serving in our government, in our various administrative branches, are tremendous patriots who want to do great things for their fellow citizens and for our country.
Right.
And the more respect you have for them and for the expertise that they've accumulated, in many cases over a very long period of time, the better you'll do your job and the better you'll be able to lead them.
Right. Well, you said that, and I know I read a long profile on Tillerson in The New Yorker, and you know, he makes that point. It's like a question about duty, but if the President of the United States calls you and wants to sit down over lunch to talk about having you be a member of his or her staff, I mean, you kind of owe it to the country to at least have that lunch, at least hear them out. And there is a sense of duty that I think a lot of senior level and executives across the country would entertain anyhow.
Listen, it's a tremendous honor to be in a position to serve your country, and especially if you believe in the president under whom you'll serve. It's a great, great opportunity. And having a diversity of skills and backgrounds in the government is really essential. The work of presidential personnel, which is the department that handles that within the White House, is an incredibly difficult one. My best friend served as the deputy in that office in the early years of the Clinton administration. I've had other friends who've done it under other administrations.
Right.
And the formation of an administration, probably John Kennedy did as good a job as anybody in either party. But I think Clinton and Obama did a superb job as well by really putting in the presidential personnel, people who understood the areas of expertise that were going to need to be applied within each of those positions.
Right.
There was a lot of respect for knowledge and expertise. There was a desire to get unique angles on problems so that they could be solved in innovative ways. But achieving that balance is tough to do. I don't think this particular administration has done as well. An awful lot of positions are unfilled as we sit here more than a year into the administration.
Right.
And I think in general it reflects a lack of respect that the president has for expertise.
In using this topic to segue into what we're going to be talking about, which is the book RFK that you've co-edited and put out for the 50th anniversary, let's flip the coin over. How important is it for business leaders to embrace the words and style and leadership that they can identify through, whether it's speech writing or, you know, different tales or case studies of political leadership? In other words, I guess what I'm going to ask you right out of the gate here is, why is it that everybody who wants to aspire to be the next CEO of a major corporation, why should they be reading RFK speeches?
That's a great question. Perhaps a very pointed answer would be made by Howard Schultz, the founder of Starbucks, who is one of the 30 world leaders that we asked to comment on Robert Kennedy's impact on them personally, as well as on the world. And we have 4 presidents, 5 Nobel Peace Prize winners, the winner of 22 Grammys, but Howard Schultz wrote a really wonderful essay about Kennedy's impact on him, on Howard as a young man, and the kind of formative characteristics that he took out of Kennedy's example. And he says in part in his brief essay at the beginning of the book, the moral courage Robert Kennedy embodied is not reserved for those who govern, because it is not only governments that shape the human condition. And he goes on to say he has 2 photographs of Kennedy in his office as reminders for all who visit to act with courage of our convictions, even as we go about business. At company meetings, I've played excerpts of the Ripple of Hope speech, which he delivered in South Africa in 1966, to condemn apartheid, as well as the discrimination in his own country.
Mm-hmm.
50 years later, his eloquent calls to strike out against injustices remain sadly relevant, but so does his hope.
Yeah, if you can't take all that and see how that can influence a young mind who wants to drive change into a society, whether it's through politics or whether it's through inventing new companies. And a lot of the companies that you're seeing is starting up take social change into consideration as they're trying to grow. They want to impact
the world. I think increasingly so. It was a huge motivation for us in setting up Snag Films. Snag Films was aiming at and has been producing the opportunity for independent filmmakers, particularly social change documentarians,
right,
to get their work out to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And so increasingly the lines between entrepreneurial private sector activities and social change mix.
No.
Okay, you were talking about social change. I want to set the context for some of the readers or listeners who are going to read this book or aren't familiar with RFK, because you do dedicate this to the young people, the people who weren't born when RFK was there. I mean, there's the baby boomers who are going to read these speeches and maybe remember them from when they were teenagers or in their 20s, but you know, you do go out of your way in your introduction to say, no, we want the other people to read it. So the 60s, you know, when post John's assassination, kind of describe the nation, the temperament, the conflict, the complexity of everything that was happening in 66, 68, leading up to 70.
Yeah, let me back up and put this into the context that I think about it. More than half of Americans today were born after Robert Kennedy was killed. Again, he was killed on June 6th, 1966, so it'll be 50 years and in a little over a week. Here was a man who was only an office holder, a United States senator, for less than 4 years. He was a presidential candidate for only 82 days. And yet, on the 50th anniversary of his death, you're seeing a major CNN six-part series air, a four-part biography on Netflix, which is superb, a number of books, including our own, many, many newspaper articles, podcasts, radio broadcasts like this. And so I think it's useful to ask, how in the world has he had this kind of impact? Why are all of these presidents and Nobel Peace Prize winners talking about his legacy and impact? And what can we take out of that into our own lives? And really, what our book aims to do is help readers, and especially those who have grown up in the last 50 years, to understand who the man is from the direct source, from his speeches themselves. We found that it was very difficult to find Robert Kennedy's principal speeches, and we wanted to present a collection of them, to put a narrative weave of his life and times around them. So the context of that era and his own development as an individual and as a leader were clear, and present them in that way. And that time, 1968 in particular, his presidential campaign, America was every bit as polarized and divided as we are now, and probably considerably more violent.
Right.
And so looking at a time where the motivating issues remain with us still as the great challenges of American life, how do you provide meaningful employment? How do you end poverty? How do you deal with the disintegration of bonds among Americans because of separations of race, of age, of gender, etc.? And what is the role of America in a complex world? All of those are the critical issues of our age. We believe that Robert Kennedy's words are both beautiful and worthwhile to read on that basis, but that he is sketching a vision of America which is considerably more hopeful than the ones we tend to hear today. And the directions he was moving in, the actual policies and proposals he was advancing, were recognizing the realities of America, not only of that time, but of our own.
Right.
And therefore, we're not doing this as an exercise in nostalgia for baby boomers. Mm-hmm. We're doing it as a call to action for everyone, and particularly the young.
Right.
Because Robert Kennedy was a huge believer in the notion that we had to rely on youth. Now, he defined youth not as a time of life, but a state of mind, a temper of the will, a quality of the imagination, a predominance of courage over timidity, of the appetite for adventure over the love of ease. That kind of youth, again, transcends chronological age.
Right.
And that kind of call, I think, goes out to all of us.
Okay, so in speaking of youth and how and Robert Kennedy's words and speeches, which is obviously what the whole purpose of this book is, I think we have to address a question of form and a question of style. And what I'm going to ask you with this, Rick, is, you know, you read any one of these speeches in your book that you've captured and you compare it to a 6:30 a.m. tweet tirade. Is elegance and word crafting dead? And if that, okay, so you can expand on that. The second one is Donald Trump's White House and Donald Trump himself, does he get it? And this is the new way to communicate, and maybe someone like myself who likes words doesn't get it and doesn't follow it at all. Or is Trump wrong and he's completely bastardizing the way that leaders should address their people, and it's just going to be a short-lived period and we're going to come back to the elegance of style of Robert F. Kennedy in the future?
Well, look, I think it's reasonable for anyone to question whether the rhetoric of another era applies to the present. And clearly in communication forms like Twitter, the preeminence is to rapidity and brevity, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got to be short and you got to be out constantly. You can't be especially eloquent in 140 characters.
Right.
So that communications form is a different kind. I think people see the strengths and weaknesses of it. But I would say even in his own time, Robert Kennedy's voice was an unusual one because of his strong belief that you never talk down to an audience. So when Martin Luther King had died, and Robert Kennedy knew the news well before the campaign rally audience that he went to visit that night in Indianapolis on April 4th in 1968, Kennedy's remarks were entirely extemporaneous. One can argue that speeches tend to be better when prepared, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's true for all of us. He, because of circumstances and time and his own, you know, deep passion on that topic, he didn't have any prepared remarks. He had a sheet of paper in his hand that he had written down some brief bullets, but he never even looked at that.
Mm-hmm.
And he spoke from the heart. We have on our website, rfkspeeches.com, the video of that, those brief remarks in that evening. And they're really quite remarkable on so many levels.
Mm-hmm.
But as to this point, they're especially eloquent. And he quotes the Greek tragedian Aeschylus, because Aeschylus's lines about grief and pain had been helpful to him, to Kennedy, in grieving for his brother's death.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was natural for him to bring it out to this audience and make that connection that he too had been a victim of violence.
Right.
I don't think, I would very much doubt that this president or many elected officials in either party have ever read Aeschylus, know who Aeschylus was, or could use him extemporaneously. I'm sure there's some.
Maybe McCain. I could see McCain.
Maybe McCain. John McCain is a great reader, and
yep.
some of his favorite authors are among mine, so I particularly identify with some of his choices. But I think you have to have a certain level of respect for your audience.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a certain both intellect and intellectual curiosity, and you have to believe that you can communicate on a high level with people of all backgrounds. And if it's authentically you, it will get across. I think that's what Robert Kennedy believed, and I think part of his appeal was that he was attempting to lead America to a better vision of itself.
Right.
It was a fearful time. He could have organized his campaign around those fears, spoken to them, but really what he chose to speak about was how we could, each of us, have an impact in making a better America.
It's tough, you know, you never want to speculate as a historian or someone who's trying to look at things, but when you see the way that words are communicated, thoughts, ideas, strategies are communicated from the White House to the people today, you do wonder if you were a historian of this era, what some, like what the Kennedys would think, you know, how would they have responded? What would an FDR think of how the White House speaks to the people? I'm talking the great orators, even a Lincoln or a Churchill, you know, how would they think? I do want to do this though, before we go, cause we're almost out of time, Rick. I think it's just fair that we end this conversation in you talking a little bit about Ed Gutzman, because this is a second version of this style of book. The first one came out, I believe, on the 25th anniversary. I know that Ed's passed away in 2008. Can you just tell the listeners a little bit about him, your relationship with him, and what he did for RFK and getting this work put together?
That's great. Thank you for giving me the opportunity. Ed Gutzman was an American hero. He was a decorated World War II veteran for his service in the Italian campaign. He came back to become a journalist, won the Pulitzer Prize at 30 for an investigative series of stories. Robert Kennedy saw those stories, saw the work Ed was doing up in Seattle, asked him to join his staff on the Senate Rackets Committee, which Ed did. They worked together, Kennedy and Gutzman, so closely during the Rackets Committee years, going after mobsters and corrupt union officials. During the 1960 campaign, Gutzman continued to be in contact with Robert Kennedy, and Kennedy asked him to come in as his communications secretary, as his press secretary in the Department of Justice. So Ed was vitally connected to Bob Kennedy throughout all of that historic time. He helped to run Robert Kennedy's campaign for the United States Senate seat in New York in 1964, and shortly thereafter went back into journalism. He was the national editor at the LA Times, the editor-in-chief at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and continued to stay close to Bob Kennedy and the Kennedy family. The families traveled, the Gutzman and Kennedy families traveled frequently. And after Robert Kennedy's death, Ed continued as a newspaper editor, ultimately retiring to Los Angeles, where he taught for 20 years at the Annenberg School at USC and was chairman of the first Los Angeles Ethics Commission, did considerable public roles there, helped to set the course for great journalists over the last 20 years. He passed away in 2008, as you mentioned. Our first edition of this book, done in 1993, occurred because of Ed. Had he not supported the idea I'd been walking around with since I was a teenager, it would never have happened.
Right.
And we wrote it together and swapped chapters and edited each other's pieces. And so this book is a direct result of him, and he was a wonderful friend and mentor.
Well, it's an homage to him. It's an homage to RFK. It's an homage to leadership, strong words, and elegance in tumultuous times, which I think America's in again. You know, you write in your introduction, there was a great divide in the 60s. There was clear struggles around war and peace, around race, around economy, around leadership, and it took strong words, and it'll take strong words again to bring it all together. So we're out of time, Rick, but thanks so much for coming in and talking about this book today.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
To let my parents meet. I wish I had a cotton candy.
continuous, positive, optimistic leadership with a refusal to back down. It's about hard work. It's about overcoming adversity. It's about getting up every morning and committing yourself to what it is you want to achieve. And today we need to read the words of Robert F. Kennedy, just like Rick Allen has put together for us in one beautiful book, to think about and to look at today's culture and how his words back in the 60s, 50s and 60s can resonate today. In the words of Kennedy, it's important that we slip the bonds of our comfort or our burdens and fully engage in the struggles of our age. This has been another episode of Book Talk with Corey. Please leave reviews wherever you get your podcasts. Stitcher, Apple Music, Google Play. Please comment on the show. Let me know how it's going. Request books, request authors, request topics. It's a two-way street, people. Thanks a lot for listening.
Now wrap it around your finger and stick it to the seat. All the boys are freaking on my cotton candy beat.
Thanks for listening to Book Talk. My name is Corey French. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Corey French. That's KoryFrench. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. Visit our show page at btrtoday.com/listen/booktalk. And get in touch if you have anything you'd like to say by emailing me at Corey French. That's KoryFrench at gmail.com. And please don't forget to subscribe.
That was great. That you, I wish we could have, that was.
You're on 90 Broad Street, New York, NY.